Welcome to the Week in Sports Cars on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires, and also presented by Graham Goodwin of DailySportsCar.com. How are you doing, my friend?
It's all good, MP. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, wherever you are in the world while you're listening to this. You're coming to me from what is again a sunny UK after a bit of more British weather of the last couple of days. Again, we're basked in fantastic sunshine.
I've been basked in a variety of sunshine, humidity, and rain here outside of mid-Ohio. Once we're done here and get this posted Tuesday morning, going to start the drive up towards Chicago. And then on to Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, for this weekend's IMSA event at Road America. Got plenty of stuff to cover today, my friend, and lots of questions. So I'm going to suggest that we mash the throttle on looking through the major topics of interest. But we do know that we have lots of questions to get to.
This month, the Marshall Pruitt Podcast is being supported by the Justice Brothers, whose line of additives, lubricants, and cleaners are America's brand for quality. The products are also used and proven by the world's top racing teams. So if you're interested in joining the sales and distribution team, Justice Brothers offers products for the automotive, semi-truck, agricultural, and industrial markets. To learn more, please check out their website at justicebrothers.com.
Before we jump into last weekend's Spa 24, which was its usual absolute production house of crazy, crazy things, not only from the winning entry to the crashes that took place to some of the injuries that were suffered to the usual management funniness. We had announcement of 2019 and many, many things related to the, should we still call it Pirelli World Challenge? That's something else we'll dive into. We have IMSA, obviously, this weekend with not just a race, Graham, but also the annual location of the State of the Union, where IMSA tends to lay out its schedule for the upcoming season, its thoughts and plans on classes and structures. I would say the one thing that we are looking forward to is finding out if the thing that I wrote about back in May regarding the need for IMSA to split its WEC P2 entries and its factory Daytona Prototype Internationals into separate championship structures will be ratified. And that is something that I continue to hear, my friend, that IMSA will do. We'll find out here. What comes to mind if that is the direction they go? Do you think that is a good thing both for the fans, and what about from an entry and entrant standpoint?
It's a great question. And, you know, wouldn't this have been a much easier question to answer before the last couple of race results we had, which saw fantastic runs from JDC Miller, from the Core Autosport guys, and for that matter, United Autosports Ligier getting involved. It would have been a heck of a lot easier a question to answer. I think it's fair to say it looks like IMSA are heading in the direction of a split. I hope what they've got is support for, well, clearly they've got support for the DPI side of that coin. I hope they've got solid support for a sustainable class if the P2 class is going to go it alone, if you like, in a pro-am fashion. I think we said on last week's show, MP, that it is not a simple thing for a number of reasons for anybody in a current P2 car to change that to a DPI. There are not many options for customer DPIs currently available, and they're not cheap. So it's a trickier call. And I think probably if I were Scott Atherton and Ed Bennett et al., I would have been feeling a little more nervous as the days went by about that call, if that's what they're going to do. The key to, for me, very simple. What are their customers saying that are currently in LMP2 cars and that other customers that might be considering coming along?
Interesting little data point to insert here, Graham. So beginning of the year, when the WEC P2s were incredibly disadvantaged compared to the DPIs. We heard from the likes of a Zach Brown, owner of United Auto Sports, saying this is silly. We need to have some sort of separate championship for our cars so that we are not getting buried by the big factories. Definitely a proponent of doing a split. Spoke with him last week, and I still need to put up the story and pose the same question to him. Now, obviously, after we've seen WEC P2s have great success, a couple races in a row, and it's not as if those victories at Watkins Glen and again at CTMP are the things that I think changed his mind, but he's actually come full circle in saying he does not want a split between the two classes because he believes it would be a much harder sell to get folks to buy in, plus pay the amount necessary to run for this, effectively a second tier prototype championship. So he said he is actively pursuing the acquisition of DPIs for any form of greater engagement in IMSA's prototype class. So not necessarily a linear thing. Some folks whose opinions might have been one thing could have changed to another. I think on the flip side, if you look at the AFS PR1 Matheson Motorsports team, they are certainly in the customer business, and I think for them, it would certainly be of benefit to have a pro-am-ish type structure. Looking at some of the other entries, though, not exactly sure if it would be best for them. So, reaction. Reaction is what I'm looking forward to getting, because I have a feeling it's going to be all over the place by the end of Friday night.
I think you're right. I think it is strange, isn't it, how a couple of results in a formula where balanced performance comes to play, it just goes to show, doesn't it, what a massive difference a change can make, not just in competitive terms, but in, for the want of a better word, political terms. That the politics here are going to be, of course, you've got a couple of extremely happy LMP2 teams, but equally you've got, I'm sure, some very unhappy DPI teams who I'm sure will be leveraging their commercial weight in the debate that carries on forward. That's, you know, it effectively is a condensed version of that same debate that we've been having in the WEC between those that would like to see the privateer teams in LMP1 having an opportunity to compete in competitive terms for the overall win, and those that say, well, why should they, bearing in mind the additional loyalty and resource that's been poured in against a set rule book by the remaining factory hybrid entry. So it's if you like, it's almost a mini version of that same debate, to my mind. I think it's going to be very interesting. Will they leave a door open, or will they just decide to go for it? To do that, MP, they're going to have to be persuaded that they have got a solid core of DPI entrants that will carry them through into and through next year. And of course, the news just recently with Tequila Patron made that a little bit more edgy.
Absolutely. Another thing we're looking forward to, Graham, as we cover off here on IMSA, is the look at what the 2019 calendar will be. Among the things I've heard, could be completely accurate or 100% false. Please don't take anything suggested here on a Tuesday as for something ready to become fact during the announcements on Friday, but have heard that there could be an alignment in the amount of rounds across all three classes in the WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. We have had 10 for the for the prototype class and 11 for both GT classes, GTLM and GT Daytona. Heard rumor that we might be looking at 10 for all. That would then lead us to ask, where might we drop one, at least GTLM race and one GTD? Have heard that GTD might not be making the trip to Canada next year at Canadian Tire Motorsports Park. But again, that could be wrong. And as for GTLM, I'm not sure if this suggestion that they will be dropping from 11 rounds to 10, where that would cleave one event from their calendar. I can say, Graham, that at least on that topic, of course we want all the racing in the world. We want constant 24-hour, never-ending endurance racing, right? At the same time, costs are only going up, and it would not surprise me, at least, if we found that in GTD and in GTLM as well, that one round came off the calendar just in the interest of trying to save a few dollars there. GTD in particular, mate, is something that cost-wise has become, it's really become staggering to consider how expensive running a GT3 car across the full calendar has become. So we will find out here in a matter of days, though, if that is
absolutely
true or false.
Right. And it's good that those things are being considered. We know that in and amongst the considerations of the prototype regulations, we know that IMSA have been wise to, for some time, the rising cost of the GTD, GT3 platform, and also the effect that, Super Silvers are having in that area, that there are remarkably few or remarkably small proportion of the GTD teams that have got real gentleman drivers in the non-professional, or in their case, lady drivers too, in the non-professional seats in GTD. It's quite correct that those things should be addressed before you get to the point of crisis, because they will be fully well aware that there is now a commercially active, commercially very aware organization in full control of the other major national championship that involves GT3 racing.
Speaking of GT3 racing, we had an event that has been on the receiving end of many suggestions from one G. Goodwin of the Isles regarding improvements that could be made regulation-wise, administratively, and how the event is conducted. How did the Spa 24-hour SRO Fest, how did that go down, in your opinion, based on all of the aforementioned concerns and criticisms you usually have for this event?
Okay, let's start with the really bad stuff. People came away from that event injured, and there is nobody from the top all the way down to the fans on trackside that want to see that happen. Get well soon, Jürgen Krebs and Andy Merrick.
So for those who are learning about this or maybe didn't have a chance to watch or read, tell us what happened.
The honest answer is, the photos are
frightening.
The photos are terrifying, and it's first worth saying this was an impact between Lamborghini for Jürgen Krebs and the older style Bentley, the team Parker Bentley, driven by Andy Merrick. It came after an earlier incident involving the Lamborghini. We don't actually know, but it would appear that head-on contact happened up at Radillon. That there was massive damage to both cars. It's worth saying at this point, though, briefly, that what's not clear, despite the predilections of some on the internet to want to throw accident photographs and speculation at the web at any particular time, how much that damage was caused by the accident and how much was caused by the extraction of the drivers from those cars. And I'll say this much, by the way, anybody out there that was speculating while all this was actually happening, just stop doing that, whether or not you are a trackside fan or, shame on you, an accredited journalist. Don't do that. That's unfair completely to everybody trying to deal with that situation. It adds further pressure and distress. And particularly when you're in a 24-hour race, some people, some of their loved ones, will be watching not the TV, but perhaps their Twitter feed. Unacceptable. Please don't do it. Take the lesson from this. We're lucky we've got two guys we can talk about, frankly, after an incident like that, that are still with us. So heavy contact, we know. Massive damage to both cars. Looked to me like the Bentley's safety cell held up pretty well, and that luckily it would appear that the impact was the side of the car in both instances where the driver wasn't. Andy I have had a brief text exchange. So Andy is in hospital, I'm sure, pretty uncomfortable. I'm not going to share details of what I know about injuries because I think that's for Andy to actually do. But I can say that I was, how can I put this, very pleased with the lack of serious injury against what I'd seen when I saw pictures of the car. So hopefully we get to hear from Andy. We can have a chat about that maybe on next week's show. But, you know, no one wants to see incidents like that. It is not the first time that that has happened in the Spa 24 Hours, or indeed another major racing at that track. It is about what is an acceptable level of risk. What else did we see? We did see a lot of caution periods. We saw a bit of a change for the Spa 24 Hours where the full course yellows then went quite often to safety car before the cars were released. I think that might be a reaction to some of the cyclical yellows breeding yellows that we've seen in the past. And I applaud Alain Adam for looking again at, you know, perhaps some lessons that could be learned from the past. Alain Adam, by the way, will be with you across the United States next year as the new race director for the Pirelli World Challenge. Beyond that, some of the racing was great. It was wheel to wheel, but then again, that's what the rule book is designed to actually encourage. Again, I'm afraid the over-management of stint lengths and in particular of pit stops just takes something away from that race for me. It makes it quite difficult to get enthusiastic about the long game. It's all a little bit designed for the immediate gratification of the moment on the TV screen or trackside, with little or no consideration of the ability of the guys on pit lane or on the pit wall. And that, for me, is what spoils it. But fantastic grid. For my taste, a little too many cars again. The national class, supported by all of two cars, kill it, pointless, just, you know, just does not, is not required in any way, shape or form at that race. And that still left us with 60 GT3 cars. I think that's a few too many. Yep. We saw the Bentleys running really very well indeed before trouble hit the factory cars. And obviously, as we said, the older car of Team Parker. We saw fantastic pace from the old lady, the Aston Martins of our motorsport, one recovering from the back, the other one running at the front until a kinked fuel line cost them time. And we saw the usual suspects out there. But happily, because we all like a bit of a fairy tale story, a surprise winner with Volkenhorst Motorsports and their BMW M6 GT3, a car that you might expect to be there, not necessarily a team that you would expect to be at the top of the shop, despite the fact that Henry Volkenhorst and his fine team have been attracting more and more factory interest of late. A good event. I'm not going to say a great event. It's better than it has been for perhaps a couple of years, but still a bit too stop-start, still too much silliness on track, and a number of drivers, again, making it clear that some of the driving standards were not what they should be of a race at this level. And Laurens Vanthoor in particular making it clear, MP, on social media, that maybe it is about time for the Spa 24 Hours, where something akin to a ring permit is required for some of the gentlemen drivers taking part in that race.
Well, there goes my entry for 2019. I can't disagree with anything Lauren said there. Also, I think there was it was pretty cool to see the driver lineup, the overall winning driver lineup itself was a solid one, obviously with some factory talent there, but also some, you could say, genuine pro-am lineup too. That's something that I had an appreciation for. If we look outside the race itself, Graham, we had the SRO make plenty of announcements. The World Challenge side is one that we should get into a little bit. And there is also an announcement, which we have a number of questions about regarding GT2. So we might save the GT2 part for Q&A. But tell us about this Pirelli World Challenge, GT Challenge USA, World Challenge USA, GT Pirelli. What are we going to call it? What did they tell us? maybe also what didn't they tell us?
Well, again, you know, a bit of a curate's egg in terms of the information given and the information specifically not offered. I should make very clear, by the way, I wasn't in Spa at the weekend. I family weekend at home. It's one of the precious few I get, but it's keeping close tabs on that. So all of the SRO Championship calendars were announced, pretty major changes for a number of them, including the Intercontinental GT Challenge, which will go to Kyalami for the first time in 2019 for a 9-hour race, basically resurrecting a famous old race from the past. But for World Challenge, lots of changes there, most of which had actually already been signposted. We speculated on which races we might lose with the GT3 cars MP. I think it was last week, but we now know where six of the seven races are going to be. It'd be COTA, VIR, CTMP, Canadian Tire Motorsport Park, Sonoma, Watkins Glen and Road America, with the grand finale, as yet still unnamed, we'll come to that in a moment, on the 5th and 6th of October. We also had another new product unveiled, and that will be announced in some more detail a little later. In addition to the Intercontinental GT Challenge, there's going to be a World Challenge, and that means a World Challenge. It will be for customer racing from manufacturers and will be effectively a second tier of global competition. That leaves the question, what about Pirelli World Challenge? Well, the new logo presented, I've just sent you a screenshot of this, MP, that describes it pretty clearly as Pirelli GT World Challenge America. Now, is that going to be part of a sub-brand, or is this something to do with amongst the collateral that the SRO actually gathered when they took the controlling interest in Pirelli World Challenge? Was that trademark World Challenge? And it strikes me, we know, and he's not made any secrets about it at all, that Stefan Rattel retains an interest in a global presence for his brand of GT racing. And quite correct that he should do so. GT3 and now GT4 have been phenomenally successful worldwide. So are we going to start to see a gradual rebranding of some of that product? Are we going to see a rebranding in particular over the next couple of years about what happens in North America with Pirelli World Challenge? We'll wait and see. As for the grand finale, well, all you can do in these instances when a championship leaves it open to the media who were there and invited to those press conferences, when you leave an open door, you expect the questions. What I didn't expect was the question to be asked by my colleague and for that to be given a frankly dismissive and, I would say, rather insulting answer, which was, and I quote, "I would have thought that was obvious. Ha, ha, ha." Well, it's not obvious. You've made it clear that it's not very obvious. If you're briefing other people, might be polite if you brief us. After all, we spent the money to actually attend your race, Stefan, for it was you. I'm not very amused by that. I'll be absolutely honest with you. I'll be making my protest for that a little later. If you don't want to answer the question, don't answer the question. Don't belittle the question, because all we're doing is asking the question. You're begging yourselves for issuing the challenge in that place. Doesn't actually help, does it? Doesn't make me feel any better about spending the money to send my guys there to cover your press conference.
Yeah. Well, when you list the schedule for a season, and the season finale is a big fat to be determined, and then you go and try and see if you can glean any helpful information from the person in charge of that calendar, and they play dumb and or are dismissive, as you mentioned, it makes you wonder if and what type of commitment or just outright disdain they might have for those like yourself, like me, like others who actually cover their competitions. And this maybe traces back to something we've discussed more than once in recent weeks, that being using the Pirelli GT World Challenge, World Challenge GT USA Pirelli by GT Challenge World Pirelli. This shift to full SRO ownership, and in what we see in the calendar here, there's a pretty strong indication that the full SRO-ness of, hey, remember how you guys were really trying to be big fan-friendly, fan-favorite, love-the-crowds type organization? Well, that's going to change. We're going to be first and foremost for the paddock, and if folks turn up to watch us, well, then good on them. But that's no longer the mission statement for World Challenge. When you mentioned this very brief incident, this wasn't any sort of, you know...
No.
This was no international incident, but to me it just seemed to fall into that that line of, oh yeah, I thought you knew, isn't it obvious, like, look, jerk, we're here, we're trying to do our job. If you don't want us to be here doing our job, that's fine, we can go away, and you guys can race in isolation among yourselves and stare at all of the lovely, lovely crowd that seems to have dressed up as aluminum grandstands, because if you don't want us here, then just say so.
It's this simple. You will know, as do I know a lot of our listeners, what I did for a living for 30 years.
Hitman.
You leave, if you leave a question as big as that, as open as it clearly is, it's on a slide with grand finale, 5th to the 6th of October, with no venue against it.
Talladega. That's what we're going to start telling folks.
Las Vegas. You heard it here first. The reality is that you are not just leaving that open. You know you're going to be asked that question, okay? The only sensible way that any organization deals with that is to determine what the answer is to that question you give before you're asked it. It's that simple. It's polite, it's constructive, and you have an answer ready. So they clearly do have an answer that's potentially could have been given. I'm just not very impressed by the level of professionalism that showed. And, you know, I'm frankly... You know, dear listener and MP, if it was Stefan standing here, I'd say exactly the same to him. Yeah, that's unnecessary. You know, the straight and honest answer is it doesn't make me feel any better about determining where I should invest what little resource we've got for covering these series into 2019. And if we do get into the stage where once again a media partnership with a championship effectively means that favoritism is shown in terms of the timing and release of news, then the reality is we just won't cover it. And that makes me very sad. We've put a lot of effort in recent years into trying to get closer to a number of series. But if this is what we have to look forward to, and I'm reading an awful lot into, not a lot here for the moment, but I want my friends at SRO to consider these matters very carefully. If you want the wider coverage, then the straight answer is you need to work a little bit harder on those relationships.
A grumpy Graham Goodwin. I love it. I love it. You're listening to The Week in Sports Cars on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. Graham, do you hear that faint sound in the background? It sounds like a jingle is cumbling.
This cumbling, that's a great word.
Fifth new word I've made up this week. I would say questions. Oh, we've got questions. We get your questions every day. Let's kick off here on the good old book face with Eric Harkrader, who says, whatever happened to the Transformers-sponsored DPI that Ian Dawson announced? Well, Eric, it was meant to be a WEC P2, not a DPI, but I wouldn't even say that that was an error in your line of questioning. I would say that was perfect accuracy, because the likelihood of the Dawsons showing up with an entry sponsored by Transformers, I would say it was just as high as them having a DPI. So why not? Let's just call it an LMP1 hybrid. I would say the odds were equal there as well. They announced that that's what they were doing. They had an LMP3 car on display when they did this last year, Petit Le Mans, Eric. And as I have, I think, written many times, mentioned on social media, and probably even said here, Graham, while I have a great affinity for Ian Dawson, he's done great things in the past in motor racing. It's been a long time since those great things were done, but he's done some great things in racing. He's a character. He has managed to show up from time to time, whether it is a car with bodywork made in part from hemp to the rattiest looking prototype I've seen in many years, with Nissan V8 powered P2 years and years ago, towards the end of the America Le Mans series window. This to me is just the latest in the long line of things that you go, bless you for announcing it. Those of us who've been around long enough will, you know, if you say you're going to do it, then we're going to put it upon you to fulfill that statement. And if you don't, then that's on you. I never expected it to happen. You hope that it does. You're fairly confident it won't. And, you know, I'll just close on this, Graham, by saying there's still a couple of rounds left in the championship, which means, in theory, there's time for another press release to tell us that some battle bots have decided to sponsor a PC entry. How's that?
Yeah, and, I think
that's what's coming next.
No, I think you're past your optimistic prime is the honest answer of the Transformers. Look, I mean, I'll say this much about Ian. Ian was the chef de camp of the very first team that I ever worked professionally with at the Le Mans 24 Hours at Ascari. He has had a huge battle on his hands to keep his hat in the ring. Sometimes that's worked, sometimes it's not. But for those enthusiastic observers of this sport, Ian and his son's journey through this is a real life example of just how tough this business is. That's what this is. It is really tough. If you've not got, you know, a vast amount of capital, you know, at your immediate bidding, you've got to hustle every day, every hour of every day, to just get these cars on track. And, you know, I'm afraid, as it has often been the case in recent years, that I'm afraid Ian has not managed to get that across the line. And that's, you know, that's a source of, you know, it's a real shame. I hope that we'll see Ian and the guys back. I think this was a step too far this year.
Let's see. Where shall we go next? Well, let's kick off here with one of the topics we mentioned up front, Graham. Alex Eichmiller. Would love to hear your opinions on the newly announced GT2 category by the SRO. Given the expense of GT3, I'm confused by the idea of a category based on cars that are even more expensive. Do you think this will be successful?
Okay, let's first and foremost, for those that haven't heard this, not only is World Challenge now a property as a name of SRO, so is GT2, and this has been some time in the offing. If you look back under the trademark applications, over a year ago was when GT2 was registered as an international trademark by SRO. What is GT2? Well, it's not what you might expect. GT2, effectively nowadays, in old money, is what we now know as GT Pro and GTLM. No more, it's not. GT2. Very confusingly, will now sit somewhere between GT3 and GT4. And the best explanation I've actually heard of what it is effectively, it's the kind of GT4 changes to a car made to cars that are further up the range. So, for instance, and this is not making an announcement for that company, whereas you have a McLaren 570S GT4, you might get a McLaren 720S GT2. It won't be as aerodynamically amended as a GT3 car. So there'll be a lot less downforce involved with these cars, but there'll be a lot more power. So in a straight line, the things are going to be rocket ships, but they'll be nowhere close as quick through the turns. The intention for SRO is that this gets a steady rollout over the next 2 or 3 years, that they are clearly expecting, as am I, some launches of cars before the end of this year. Stefan Rotella, the press conference, mentioning 1, 2, or maybe 3 different cars. And in year one, they will race in sprint racing only and in amateur hands only. Cue here for the level of questioning about lack of downforce. In the first year, it will be in the Blancpain Sports Club, which is for the true amateur drivers and drivers over a certain age as well that currently race in GT3 cars. So you'd be able to have a GT2 car in that. And also in the British GT Championship. The following year, it will roll out into a range of other SRO properties, including Pirelli World Challenge. And Blancpain Sprint Series as well, but not Blancpain Endurance. And these cars will not race, for instance, in the Intercontinental GT Challenge. So, for instance, not at Bathurst, not at Spa 24 Hours, not at the California 8 Hours, etc. Why are they doing this? Well, I'm guessing they're doing it because some manufacturers have told them that actually they would quite like to launch cars like this, and they believe they have customers for them. I think it's a little bit of body armor to catch people that otherwise might fall through the cracks of exactly what we were talking about earlier, MP, which is the cost of GT3 racing. Effectively, these can be pretty mildly safety amended, principally road cars, top of the line road cars, not an Aston Martin Vulcan, not the kind of the concept or hypercars, but top of the range super sports cars. So quite where that line lies, I think, is to be determined by the manufacturers that will prepare the cars. But I think we're going to hear more about this from one or two or three manufacturers in the weeks and months that follow. The fact that we didn't have a car unveiled at Spa isn't, I think, a reason to think that this is a kind of finger in the wind. This is a real thing, and we will be hearing about cars. Inevitably, they will get customers. Quite exactly how those cars will race against GT3 cars remains to be seen. They're going to be quicker in a straight line. They're going to be much, much slower around the turns.
Wow. Well, that sounds awesome, because when I think of GT2, I think of lower performance because the number is lower. No, wait. All right. I'm confused. I'm not.
But well, no,
maybe the concept's confused. But
a ladder that says GT4, GT2, GT3 is inherently confusing. There's no doubt about that. I kind of applaud what they're trying to do. They're trying to respond to what we said they needed to quite some time ago. Have they got it right in terms of the nomenclature? I'm not sure they do. Let's wait and see how this one actually pans out. There is an element, though, is the reality is if next year we find that we've got a grid in Blancpain GT Sports Club of 6 to 12 of these cars, they're not going to give a tuppenny about what you or anybody else thinks. It will be cars on the grid. Remember what we've told you before, SRO's business concept revolves around getting cars on the grid plus getting the suppliers, the key suppliers in to provide that income. They do provide great racing worldwide. They're not necessarily that concerned, as MP said a little earlier in the show, with the active promotion of some of those events. It is about actually having a sustainable business model on the track. And let's face it, who can quibble with the numbers that you see in the likes of the Blancpain Endurance Series, the Spa 24 Hours, the Blancpain GT Series in Asia, etc., etc.? The reality is these are successful events.
Let's jump to a couple of fun ones here. Shay Small, who we've learned is a dude and not a chick.
From
last week's episode. Says, hey, MP and GG, what's your favorite racing driver's name? Will Power, Stig Blomqvist, etc. Who's your pick?
It's a club driver. It's a club driver, and this goes back to my early days of watching motorsport with my son. And it seemed to me that every single club event always had a race with the old style minis, and the two guys who were running at the front in, I think it was Mighty Minis at the time. And it's the thing around having the surname in the rear left hand window of the car. So as it's passing us at Paddock Hill Bend, you could see the name. And it was the lead driver who was leading the race was a guy called Michael Jackson, not that one. So Michael Jackson said, that's not him. It was the guy who was second. So you've got Michael Jackson coming through sideways through Paddock Hill Bend, followed by Death. D-E-A-T-H. His name is actually Harvey Deeth, and he's a lovely, lovely man. I've met him much more recently.
Death is calling right now, we can hear. Yes, the Grim Reaper is on the phone.
That was, I thought I'd take the battery out of the phone. I had. Unfortunately, there were two phones in here. But Harvey Deeth, just because it's funny to see it on the side of a car.
You know, the one whose name, I guess, never stood out to me as amusing, but I mention this somewhat regularly when folks ask, is Ryan Hunter Ray, IndyCar champion, Indy 500 winner, sports car driver, etc. And in English, his name, you know, has a little bit of a cadence to it. It's fine, but nothing outstanding. But the fun thing, Graham, each year going down to Brazil for the IndyCar street race in Sao Paulo, well, in Portuguese, the letter R is pronounced as an H. So whenever his name was mentioned over the PA system, you would hear something about the car number, 28, et cetera, et cetera. Ryan Hunter Ray. And I'm like, that's pretty darn good. Good old Triple H. Ryan Hunter Ray. Yeah. So
it sounds like something out of a Robin Hood movie, doesn't it?
Exactly. So that that would be mine there.
There's one other honorable mention here. And I can't remember whether this has ever been mentioned before on the Weekend Sports Cars podcast, but it's going to be mentioned now. And that comes courtesy of the track announcer at Sebring some years ago, who, it has to be said, was hilarious. Had absolutely no clue whatsoever how to pronounce more or less anybody's name. We had Simon Pagenaud. It was hilarious. I think he just had to stop four times. We had Gerard Larousse was out there demonstrating a Porsche 917, and Gerard was Greg LaRussi was that one. My favorite though, famously, and now well known to his Porsche factory racing pals, was the forever known in DSC circles as Roman Dumbass.
Yeah. Well, Roman's name, if Beavis and Butthead existed before he was born, you would swear that that was something they came up with, because you can just hear Roman Dumbass as the perfect lisping last name pronunciation. So, yes, delightful. And look, it's not as if pronunciation always works perfectly with this little face of mine. So let's go to Steve Smith Jr. If you could have a 6-hour multi-class street race anywhere in the world, where would you choose for it to be?
Easy.
Guernsey?
No, right here, because I wouldn't have to travel to watch it. I could watch it from upstairs, right here down my street. And by the way, I would insist that they don't move on the cars that are parked either side of the road either. I think it would be, you know, as for literally everything from, you know, top fuel dragsters down to, I don't know, the mighty minis, right here. I mean, that I'd pay to sit in my own front window and watch that.
Wow, that is great. I think I would go with the same kind of locally based idea. Not, well, I couldn't actually sleep in my bed because it takes so long to get back and forth, but I think the 6 hours of San Francisco has an amazing ring to it, because if you've watched if you've watched Bullet, if you've watched any movie where a car chase took place in San Francisco, you know that getting air is just commonplace. So those amazing photos from back in the day of Formula cars and GT cars leaping through the air at the Nürburgring at certain corners.
Yep.
I would say that would just be pretty much in every corner instance here or there in the Bay Area. And knowing that some of the roads are extremely rough, you could go all over. I mean, it would be pretty amazing. So I think, Steve, we need to have the 6 hours of San Francisco, and it would be amazing.
Yeah.
I would just want to shoot the thing. I wouldn't even want to report on it. I'd just be a photographer.
It did have. Am I right? There was, in the mists of time forgotten, a street race in LA for NASCAR. Am I right about that?
Not that I recall, but I don't pretend to be a NASCAR historian, nor there are many other things I also don't pretend to be. So, and that's one of them. let's see, a good judge of character, someone who eats as many vegetables. I don't claim to be that guy as he should.
Not a big fan of costume musicals. No.
No. Boy, we have a number of questions about GT2 here, and
don't we just?
I would say, Graham, this also speaks to the topic of, well, sports car enthusiasts tend to be the most plugged in, the most curious, wanting to know all the machinations of how things
and let's
work.
Let's face it, and the most attractive, all of them.
Yes, I mean, just the amount of love and relationships going on in each paddock, it's pretty amazing. But I would say, I'm assuming here, potentially making an ass out of you and me, that the number of questions regarding this GT2 announcement could stem from a severe lack of clarity. I had to read into this a little bit. There's a lot of assumptions here, but yeah, you'd also just have to say, hey, we're gonna do this new thing. What is it? I don't know, but it's a thing. Okay, have you come up with a name? Yeah, GT2. Okay, so what's it gonna be? Cars, definitely cars. We're gonna go with cars. Who's gonna drive it? People. We're committed to people. We thought about dogs, thought about monkeys. Concerns about the windows being closed and throwing of poop. So we decided to go against the monkeys, but we're going to go with their evolutionary brothers, human beings. So I think
I'm going to object. Not human beings. It's just before human beings. It's race drivers.
Fair enough. That slightly subprime human beings. I would say, you know, actually, to the organization that's now affiliated with them, I do recall, I don't know if it was this year or last year, but I do remember sending a note to a friend at the World Challenge Series after they fired off a press release that had a lot of information in it about some changes and said, take this, leave it, tell me to shut up, whatever you want. I'd almost suggest sending out a new press release, because the one that just went out either has so many holes in it or is so confusing or answers so few things while raising more questions that actually get answered. You might actually benefit from just taking another crack at this. And,
It's often the problem when you try to wrap up everything in one particular announcement, because there's never enough time to drill into the level of detail that people want. And then, of course, it's coming right before your biggest race of the year, in this instance, with the Spa 24 Hours. So to a degree, it's a rod for their own backs that they have created. That said, generally speaking, SRO and the associated championships do like to manage the news pretty rigidly, and it may well be that this is part of the strategy. Let's wait and see. There's an awful lot of questions. The fact of the matter is, like it or loathe it, a lot of people asking questions are therefore interested in what those answers might be. They could have got it right.
Should we invoke the first, if you only knew what we knew? Hey, we've got this far and haven't mentioned BOP, and that isn't our first use of BOP because it's not attached to anything. We might, Graham, end up with our very first episode with zero BOP usages, which would make me really happy. Maybe that will be a trend. Maybe that'll be the clarity where episodes future, maybe even past, we can go back in time and scrub BOP. Maybe not. I should stop drinking this early. It's only 10:15 in the morning. All right. I'll take the next one, mate, here on Facebook, and then why don't you grab a few more after. Justin Walsh, MP, the year is 2020, and WWE founder Vince McMahon has just called requesting that you spearhead a single car prototype effort, with the only stipulation being that your drivers must be current or past WWE superstars. Who would be your two primary drivers, and who would you choose to supplement the longer endurance races? Justin, you are a man after my heart here, knowing how much I loved the WWF growing up, and now that my wife, as fully grown adults with college educations, still embrace the pro wrestling that we loved separately when we were young and have come together to love it once again. That is a great question. I would say, and for those who don't follow WWE, this is probably really bizarre and meaningless, but that's okay. That's a good encapsulation of most of my life. I would say Finn Balor comes to mind. Finn Balor, fairly focused, obviously very fit. He just strikes me as someone that could lock into that zone. And I would say a teammate, because he needs a little bit of a wild card. I would say Seth Rollins. That would be some fun. I also love the fact that if anybody took either of these guys off, that little trackside meetup, or what would go down on pit lane once they climbed out of the car, a suplex, sleeper hold, one of them looking to jump off the top of the refueling tower to slam someone. I mean, there's a lot of great options here. As for the endurance lineup, gosh, who would I look for one of the final drivers? You know, I would pick Charlotte Flair, daughter of Ric Flair. She's a supreme athlete as well. So I would probably stray more towards the athletic end, Justin. And also, Graham, realizing that many pro wrestlers are just so physically massive that getting into a prototype, I mean, they would have to open both doors, stick their legs in, and just kind of straddle it and hope that they have some sort of big steering wheel popping out of the windshield, because there's no way they could fit inside.
Like wacky races.
Yeah, there you go. So that's my at least first pass, Justin. I'll think on this some more, though. There could be some other options.
Let's have a quick look a bit further down here. Okay. Tim Sain is a good one. With all the possible confusion about what's to happen, about there being even more GT cars, is another one that I think talks to GT2. What prototype, current or past, would you like to see a road-going version of? His answer is an Intrepid RM1, ideally in an awful pearlescent purple hue, equally awful chrome wheels and kit-inspired electronic dashboard. Well, we have had, of course, a number of road-going versions of essentially what are prototype races, including famously at least two versions of the Porsche 962. There's been a road-going 917. There is actually even a guy turns up regularly at Silverstone in a road-going version of what is a Jaguar XJR9, would you believe? It's an amazing thing. It includes a lot of original spare parts from the original race cars. What would I like to see? I'm almost minded, just because it would be atrociously appalling, to say the Cannibal again. But we've covered the Cannibal before, so maybe move on from that.
I have one. Well,
go on.
Ford GT. I think a road version of the Ford GT GTLM race car would be fantastic. I mean, imagine that, Graham. Imagine seeing these amazing cars running in red, white, and blue in IMSA, and also in the WEC. Imagine seeing those actually coming down the production line.
Look, you've gone too far now. I know we want amazing.
Again, I'm drinking early today.
I think, you know, no, you've gone too far. I think, I'd like that very last, supremely ugly and brilliant in every way about it, Audi R18. Can you imagine that thing turning up at your local Walmart? Can you imagine someone coming back with some lumber strapped to the top of one of those things to take it home for the latest DIY job? I think that would be absolutely outstanding and be utterly brilliant as well, the traffic light Grand Prix.
A Christmas tree duct taped to the rear wing.
Oh, yes.
That would be good fun. Or just sticking out of the passenger seat. pine cones getting in and among the pedals and whatnot. But yeah, that I love that idea.
There was a project which didn't sadly come to fruition. You may remember, MP, the very last Lister race car, the LMP. Now, that car, for there was only ever one, was due to be transformed into a road-going hypercar, but for whatever reason, possibly because someone woke up and realized that it had been a really heavy night at the bar, that never did actually come to fruition. But I'd love to see it. I think, you know, anything bonkers like that. I have seen some utterly bonkers stuff on the road, including race cars adapted for road use. You know, I'd love to see it. I'd love to see that. Great question.
Where should we go next, my friend?
Let's have a look a little bit further down. We've got some questions around the update on the status of the drivers from Spa. We'll keep you posted on that. I'll make sure that our friends at Racer get the same copy once we've heard from Andy. What car hasn't yet been Legoized? Yes, she's made that word up. That you desperately wish would be? For me, it's the Ferrari 365 GTC4. Gorgeous shaped car. That comes from Shia Adam. That's the shade that is a bird, not a dude. Apologies, Shay. A lady. What car would you like to be Legoized?
I don't know why it popped into my head, although that's a phrase that I say many times each day. Something about a Shelby Daytona Coupe that I think, because one of the issues in Lego-sizing things is you have these sharp corners in most instances. Yep. Not all, but for the most part, we're talking blocks. And knowing how round and swoopy and gorgeous that Peter Brock-designed machine was, I would love to see if and how our friends at Lego could produce something, at least enough pieces so you could honor those curves. Because doing the doing an Audi, an old Audi DTM car, or pick some sort of boxy GT car, that's easy because it kind of fits the shape of what you're using to make them. But I think something as beautiful and swoopy like the Shelby Daytona Coupe, that I think would be a cool project if there were appropriate Lego blocks to pay tribute to that round shape.
Well, in a similar kind of vein, they've done a couple of large-scale ones. There's an excellent large-scale Porsche 911 GT3 RS. There's an excellent large-scale generic LMP2 prototype that one of my good friends in the PR world transformed into a open-top Gibson prototype for Strecker Racing. Fantastic stuff. And you know, we were carrying this thing down through the paddock for a photo shoot, and it was just like moths to a flame. He had three offers from other teams to do bespoke models for him in about 40 feet, it has to be said. But for me, if again you could cover off those, say, a large scale Group C car, I think would be immense. You know, but again, you'd have to get that the streamlined nature of the bodywork pretty correct, rather than being overly blocky. And the only way to do that is for it to be pretty large scale. I'd buy that for significantly more than a dollar.
Let's see. Well, here's a question that you touched on a little bit in terms of safety car interventions and or issue processing last weekend at Spa. David Zitterbart, we have, you know, one thing, Graham, we have some a number of great folks who send in questions each week from down under. So hello to our prison colony friends.
Absolutely. They get out Tuesdays normally, get a bit of sunshine before getting back on the treadmill.
Just as a quick sidebar before I get to David Zitterbart's question, last week on the Week in IndyCar, my guest was Indy 500 winner Will Power, a fine representative from Toowoomba, Australia. And the funniest darn question we got was from someone on Twitter who asked something along the lines of, have you ever done your genealogy and been able to trace back to exactly which criminal you are you descend from? And so while I'm dying and cracking up, Power, because he's half insane, actually took it somewhat seriously. He's like, no, I'd actually like to know. That's something I need to do. I need to find out. So I also mentioned that some of my distant relatives in the 1800s, at least according to my father, and assuming this wasn't something he told me when he had his drink on in my youth, but mentioned that there had been at least one member of the Pruitt family hung for horse stealing. So, you know, we could say that while I'm not of Australian lineage, I would say that the old prison colony and or folks being retained in perpetuity for the afterlife. Certainly there's a bit of that in the Pruitt household as well. But let's get back to David's question here. Hey, guys, what did you think of the way the safety car was used during the Spa 24? If you missed it, what they did was call a full course yellow and left the pit lane open, allowing all cars to pit without too much congestion. Then for the last lap or two, they sent the safety car out and gathered the pack up. I think it would work great in IMSA to avoid those darn 25-minute long pit cycles. Did you were you able to catch that, Graham, and
yes.
see that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Referred to a little earlier in the show, and I thought it worked pretty well. It does. There is no perfect solution. I think that's what we've all come to. There is no perfect solution. What Alain Adam, I think, was trying to do there was to keep things safe, which is his principal priority, correctly so. Could it provide the answer? There are two things about IMSA racing in the recent past that I have to say have jarred with me. One is exactly what David actually describes there. The longer yellows just take too long. They just do. And in particular, when you get into the shorter races, it's a huge proportion of the race that it seems this caught up with that. The other one is I'm not a big fan of allowing the level of contact, which certainly I saw at Watkins Glen, go as no further actioned as it was. I think that sends some unfortunate messages up and down the pack. But I think, as I've said before, yes, I thought it worked reasonably well. Does it mean that hard-won gaps are gone in more or less an instant? Yes, it does. But I think at this point, you've got to pay your money and take your choice as to what it is you want from those caution periods. What I want to see is not what we saw several years ago at Spa, which was, I think, three or four occasions. It was just massive accident after massive accident up at Radeon as the cars were released. We were back into another accident and then again and again. That's what they are keen to avoid. Should say, by the way, it partially answers the point raised by, we said earlier, Laurence Ventura about training. SRO have adopted the standards suggested by the Sean Edwards Foundation. And in part, I'm sure this is because of the work that's being done in that particular vein. I think it is a good thing to see how these things work out in reality. I go back to what I think I said on last week's show, which is I'd like to see a lot more work between the major championships working together on exactly this issue, particularly where you've got mixed class racing, or in the case of the Spa 24 Hours, mixed ability racing within GT3 classes.
Mixed ability racing. That is an awesome phrase right there. That needs to be a hashtag. Hashtag mixed ability racing in today's endurance event.
I think the issue here is, how do you maintain safety and keep a coherent event? It's massively tricky. There are a lot of very good people working really hard to make this happen, to retain the competition that we all relish, the racing we all relish. Nobody's doing what they do just to piss you off. They're not doing that. They're trying their level best to balance the two often conflicting priorities of safety and entertainment. And that's not always very easy to do. I thought it worked pretty well. I think there are always ways and means that you can play with these kind of systems. As always, I would always value a sit down with the powers that be and the people involved in this to have that open discussion to find out what's in their head rather than what we presume they're trying to achieve. But I thought it worked pretty well in exactly the same way, by the way, when we had the rain affected race down in Fuji for the WEC last year, where we were going from full course yellow into slow zone or other ways of actually getting traffic through the tricky turn one area before the field was let go. We'd go from a full course yellow into a slow zone, get the cars under control through the area where you could guarantee there was going to be further drama as everybody got back up to speed, and then let them go. They've then got a full lap to sort themselves out. I think we need to treat our race directors, our stewards, etc., as people with the right motivation and high intelligence and experience of trying to deal with what is often a very tricky set of circumstances.
going to grab a couple of quick questions here on Facebook and then grab a few more on Twitter and bid farewell to our episode, Graham. And I think there will be no need to split it into two, since I don't think we're going to venture beyond much past an hour here. A little bit of a catch-up. John D. says, hi, both. I may have missed it, but I don't recall any discussion on the EOT changes in P1. Is this a case now if we've let Toyota win Le Mans? Now let's make the EOT actually E, equivalence of technology. And as mentioned above, GT2, WTF. John, we did get into the most recent EOT changes. And yeah, I don't want to crack this back open again, but I would say the general consensus between Graham and I was, we were told this would be addressed suitably for Le Mans. It was not in any way, as everyone witnessed. It frankly ruined any chance of LMP1 being a quality portion of the event. And we have read that they recognize that. We have read that they are making changes. And we will see what happens. As for making any statements beforehand as to what we think we might see, well, we were silly enough to think that might play out the way it should at Le Mans. So we will reserve comment as for the efficacy of what might come down from the changes here. Ed Joris, Graham, has a great question here. He says, curious, what do you think of the wisdom of PWC dropping IndyCar events mostly and going all in on teams and drivers as stakeholders instead of fans? So next year, instead of racing in front of 40,000 or so at Road America with IndyCar, they are, going to race on their own in front of, what, 40, maybe 400, friends and family? How are they going to replace that exposure? What are potential paying drivers going to find out about the series and aspire to compete? Seems short-sighted to me. Ed, we raised some of these topics last week as well, which is just this, and today too. The general philosophy change with the SRO now in charge of, they are no longer, I shouldn't say no longer. SRO has never really been about the person buying the tickets to sit in the grandstands and watch. Not as if fans aren't welcome, but they look to their paddock as the number one audience to satisfy. They do not go into each round thinking, what kind of show can we put on to entertain our fans? It is, what can we do that is going to make our ownership base, our drivers, our manufacturers happy to keep them here and investing for the future? Where I think this might be short-sighted, as you mentioned, Ed, is that's really not how we do things in North America. And I don't just mean motor racing. I mean in general. If someone bought a stick and ball league and said, hey, we're effectively just going to make this for the teams that play and don't really care so much if people actually turn out to watch it, it wouldn't last. It wouldn't last a season. We're in a little bit of a different situation here, Ed, where obviously the paddock, by and large, is the one that funds the competition. So as long as those folks are satisfied and bought in, then this World Challenge GT USA by Pirelli Challenge USA GT World Challenge GT, whatever they're going to call this new thing that is going to run standalone for all of its headlining GT races, well, they're now the headliner. They're no longer tapping into a big crowd showing up for a much bigger event to have them as part of the undercard. So are we going to see them fall off the map a little bit in that regard? I think so. TV package, I'm sure they will still be on television, so I don't think that is in jeopardy. But yeah, we're going to find out. I think they are going to find out very quickly that what the SCCA, when it was in charge, when it founded and then was in charge of World Challenge for a couple of decades, and then when the paddock-based ownership group WC Vision took over, all the good work they have put in to try and make this a fan-friendly thing, the best racing you'll see on, you'll see anywhere, and all sorts of taglines they've used over the years to try and entice folks to come and watch their product and fall in love with it. I think the SRO are going to have a rude awakening here that you cannot cut out the paying fan and customer and expect this thing to really continue to grow and or thrive. And I'll just draw back to one final point on this, Graham. It's a great thing when you have a paddock that's fully invested. That is effectively your source of financing and income to make a championship happen. What happens, though, to Ed's point, when you have, say, some new folks coming in saying, hey, I'll go give this a try, and you go to an event and there aren't very many people there? That is hard to ignore. If you are a successful business person who is going to go racing and you want to bring your family and, you know, there's ego involved. You want to look important, feel important, give the impression that you're doing something really meaningful. Well, if you're going to a professional event and spending a lot of money and it looks like you're at an amateur event, like you're at a SCCA club race or NASA club race, which is zero fans and it's just truly amateurs spending money for fun, when you scale that up to the pro level and it still has the look of an amateur event because no one is there and watching, we've seen in the past, Graham, that those folks spending the money to buy a car and race it or pay a team to be in their car, usually isn't long before they say, huh, are there other options where I can spend round about the same money or something in the same hemisphere, but feel like I'm actually a part of something where people show up and watch it, and it feels like an event, a real sporting event.
It's worth saying, though, where and I don't disagree with that, okay? As a flip side to this, with the Blomper Endurance Series, an incredibly happy paddock, and the paddock itself was buzzing because there's a huge number of people, some impressive manufacturer presence in there, and for the most part, those people spending the money are not leaving that paddock atmosphere. So what's happening from SRO is huge investment in actually putting the paddock together in a way that makes it look, you know, exactly what it was. It was a nice place to be. Oddly, SRO did put money into promoting the Silverstone race, and were massively disappointed with the turnout, I understand, this year. Not a very good turnout at all for anything other than race day, and I don't think it improved much for race day. So I think they are trying to see whether or not they can add that arrow to their quiver. But it's, you're absolutely right. Historically, it has not been a key part of their modus operandi, with the single sole and only exception of the GT1 World Championship for those couple of 3 years that was a thing. But you know, they have on occasion looked to promote these events. And I think, you know, they would be amongst the first to say that has not, generally speaking, been our forte. You're right, if you're looking to build something and you're looking to build something in a competitive environment, that's when that potentially can fall short, which is another of the reasons why they tend to try to dominate the landscape in any particular marketplace where they are active. In the United States, that's not going to be the case.
Yeah. So, and this is all, to be completely transparent, this is all being said, once again, as someone who has worked in the World Challenge paddock. I haven't done it, I haven't worked there in terms of running a car, you know, engineering, managing, whatever, but I spent a lot of years of my life in that paddock, want to see it succeed, was happy to see the SRO come in and take a stake of ownership, and yeah. I guess maybe this is a provincial mindset, but I think they had the potential for growing this domestic product here. I'm optimistic and hopeful that things will not go backwards with a very fundamental change of what Pirelli World Challenge will look like going forward with its new owners applying a very significant, proven European blueprint to a market that I'm not convinced they fully understand here in North America, but audience size and paddock feedback will dictate whether they got it 100% right and I got it 100% wrong. We will know by the end of next year.
I'm going to run through two or three really quickly. Tom Wilfell asking about Johnny Cocker. Will we see him back in IMSA? Hope you do. Johnny's been busy with business interests outside or alongside motorsports for a number of years. We have seen him back in the LMS and with success in the last couple of years. Will he come back full time? I think it's unlikely, but I hope we'll see him on the odd occasion. His driver ranking might get to the stage where that becomes pretty interesting in the pretty near future, because obviously as someone who's not an active driver but with a cracking driving record behind him, that could be interesting. A couple of people too, including Douglas Holtzman, noting a familiar voice on the live stream for the Spa 24 Hours. Yes, indeed, it was Bob Varsha. Mm. And what a welcome thing that was. The golden tones of Bob Varsha, I thought, added immeasurably to my enjoyment of the live stream.
Now Paris-based, making it...
Is he really?
Yes. Yes, good old Bob. I tell you, that's the kind of money, Graham, that can be made in motorsports commentary, apparently.
Wow.
You can move from Georgia to Paris. Maybe not, but I guess I should tell Bob next time I am in lovely France, please clear off the couch. I'll be looking to stay there. I love Bob. He is truly just not only the best, but also just a wonderful human being as well. So he has been my commentary kind of magical animal that I've always aspired, that granted will not ever have the kind of talent that he does, but getting to do I was able to do one race with him and spend a couple hours with him doing commentary last year, and it was everything you would think would be, Graham. Where you go, gosh, this man's mind, it is a steel trap for everything that's happened ever. So his callback abilities are amazing. His ability to improvise just on the fly has no peers whatsoever. And then just the fun banter. Yeah, anyways.
Here's the other thing about Bob Varsha. I've only met Bob two or three times for anything other than a quick hello in a corridor, but the very first time I met him was in an elevator in a hotel in Austin when I was calling WEC, and I think he was doing the same for US TV. I recognized him. He recognized my voice when I spoke to my colleague, and that we introduced each other, and he was just the most individually charming man, exactly what you would hope from any kind of hero you have in any kind of business. We need more like that, don't we? I'm going to cover off another couple of really quick ones, Dennis. Chosek, I apologize, Dennis, if I've not pronounced that right. Have I been to Road America before? I've not. It is on my bucket list. If not, will I ever make the pilgrimage? I will, surely. A gearbox double brat is on me if he does. I'm guessing that's a sausage rather than some kind of holidaying university student.
Or a very cranky transmission, something
possible.
Like that. Yes.
Right, there was another one here. It's Michael Bredjic. Hello, during the last 24 hours of Le Mans, there was also a race for the Aston Martins. In the festival race, it was indeed. In the race, the new Vantage GT3 was racing for the first time. One of the commentators told us that the lap time of the new GT3 was faster than the new GT2. Don't say GT2. Not anymore. He can't use that anymore. GTE. This was because the new GT3 was not backed up by the BOP. There you
Bob.
Go. First.
Oh, man.
If this is true, could you take a GT3, take all the BOP things holding it back in lap time, and go to the ACO, get it reformed to the new GT2 spec? Well, I know what you're asking there. The answer is yes and no. The potential power from a GT3 car is enormous, potentially 650 brake horsepower from very many of those cars. They are then clobbered back to something like 500. GTE cars, typically, was talking to one of the guys at Le Mans this year, 480. But they have more advanced aerodynamics. There's all sorts of reasons why GTE lap times are as good as they are. The reality is that you could match those lap times between the two with an ever more complicated BOP. And indeed, there are cars that are GT3 cars. You switch off the electronics, you make a couple of minor changes, and they can run in GTE. The Ferrari 488 is one of them. Would the manufacturers want that to happen? I think the answer is, and has been proven by negotiations in recent years, no, they wouldn't. Would the powers that be accept, for instance, a GT3 car of a type that's not currently running in GTE on that grid? Well, proven by the fact that BMW tried and failed to do that, the answer is no, they wouldn't. Is it an ideal situation where you've effectively got two different sanctioning bodies, with a bit of a stockade around their rule book? No, it isn't. Does it look like changing anytime soon? No, it doesn't. It's rather a shame. So you're then left with trying to persuade manufacturers to do both. And if they won't, you've got to take your money and you take your choice. Reality was, you're absolutely right, Michael, the GT3 Vantage was running without any kind of BOP applied to it. The GTE Aston Martin was running with very significant balance of performance, as we saw from the timing screens. But make no mistake, you take all the BOP measures off those cars and run them as they were conceived, and you would be seeing significantly quicker cars out on track. BOP is there for three reasons. I'm going to be straightforward about two, and I'm going to be cynical about the other. Three reasons are that by having an equality of competition to a degree, you breed more stable and potentially more varied grids, because stability means that people can come in and compete. Number two is that you do get the opportunity to adjust that performance around through any given season. And the cynical bit is you can play politics if that's what you want to do. And rather tragically, very often, that is exactly what happens.
I want to play politics. No, I don't. That was a very, very big lie.
Not at this day and age, mate. Not at this day.
Let's see. All right. Why don't I... I'm going to go with two quick final questions and one very brief comment here. Thank you. We'll go to Russell G. It says, thanks for the impromptu photography lessons on previous podcasts. My photos from Lime Rock have a bit more feel to them than the ones I took last year at Watkins Glen. Russell, our pleasure. And if you have any questions, not just about sports car racing, but about photography or whatever else that either I do or Graham happens to do, don't be afraid to send those in as well.
Absolutely.
And then I'll jump over here to John Sable. John, I always appreciate your questions because there's usually some sort of humor or snark in them. What was your favorite rule from the rules of the 24-hour last weekend? In all seriousness, between rules such as the 5-minute mandatory brake pad change, why, and hours of cautions, I lost interest and turned it off.
I could give the answer about the 5 minutes. The theory behind it is to stop the manufacturer spending a vast amount of money on quick change braking systems. Reality is, my reaction to it is much the same as yours. It's immediately the car comes into the pits for that. You just turn off. It is effectively 2.5 minutes of pointless standing about while the car could be out there running quickly. And when we look at the level of money that is being spent in GT3, frankly, a quick change brake system, words fail me is the honest answer. There's actually a great example of why it doesn't work with one. I think, but in fact, both of the R Motorsport Aston Martins, one had to stop early for a brake change. I suspect because Nicky Team had been in it and had driven the thing through the field. Nicky, by the way, went from 62nd position at the start of that race through the field to when he pitted at the end, roughly the end of the first hour, albeit assisted with two or three cars having pitted ahead of him. He pitted from 20th position in an hour. So he passed something like 42 cars, either on track or in the pits. Exceptional stuff. But the point I was about to make is that the car came in and required an earlier brake change. I think the other R Motorsport Aston did too. But because they'd done that outside of the window for that 5-minute technical stop, they had to do it again. They had to come in for a 5-minute brake change, whether or not they needed it.
Wow. I mean, they could have put the old brakes back on. No, hold on. Wait a minute. All right, let's save the last question here for good old Baxter. If you could completely rewrite the sports car rule book to eliminate the junk that's built up and been mentioned in recent episodes, driver ratings, BOP, track limits, etc., but had to keep one annoying section of the rule book intact, this is such a great question, which rule book section would you keep? So since we play among a variety of championships, Graham, is there something maybe on the WEC side that annoying that, something where you go, okay, I'll keep that because there maybe has some value to it, even if it's a little bit silly.
Oh, they've all got value. I mean, they've all got value.
That's nonsense, first of all. Yeah, I guess it's also a perspective.
It's whether or not it's outweighed by its annoyance, isn't it? I quite like full course yellow. I quite like the theory of full course yellow. I like the fact that I know there's been a huge amount of work done to work with the teams and in particular the drivers to try to underline how important full observation of that is in order to keep the race running in the way that everybody would like it to run. I come back again to that point where there is no perfect system. There just isn't a perfect system. There are systems that are significantly more perfect than others. But full course yellow for me did make a fundamental change in a positive way to both the way in which an incident could be managed and indeed how strategy actually evolved. I am not one of these guys that, you know, holds strategy to my kind of pounding chest, you know, like a mark of honor, but it has a massive part to play. It is a very large piece in the jigsaw, but it did make a difference that smart people could work their way through to see whether or not they could take some advantage in those caution periods. And I like that. I like the fact that smart people have to think on their toes really very fast indeed to determine whether or not pitting now or waiting will be an advantage or a disadvantage. We saw that time and time again in the last 2 or 3 years where we had three and then two hybrid LMP1 teams, for instance.
I would go with what I find annoying, but realize that there is value for others. And that would be the required markings and or numbers and or colors in IMSA's WeatherTech Championship to denote not only car number, but which class particular cars conform to. I don't need a specific end plate color, wing end plate color being green or red or such things to know that, hey, that yellow Corvette, it's not a prototype. It's also not in GTD. That's in GT Le Mans. I also know that when I look at a white Ferrari with WeatherTech on it, I don't need special colors to know that, oh, that's in GTD, not in GTLM, and it's still not a prototype. But I also recognize that while I find such things annoying and unnecessary, you have track marshals who might only see these cars once a year, or fans who do not spend their lives blathering on about it like Graham and I do, who might not know why one particular Porsche model is different from another and in different classes. I would also say that while it was annoying, it was also funny, but I've even come to like it, I guess, even though I thought it was annoying. Andrew was when we had the 2014 officiating debacle at Sebring, where we penalized the wrong Porsche, then penalized what we thought was the right Porsche, which was still the wrong Porsche, and came back to race control, looking at in-car footage, and at least for them being unable to discern which of the factory Porsches was at fault, etc. Afterwards, there was a mandate that every in-car camera must have the car number placed directly in front of the camera view so that if they do happen to catch transgression, they will know which number of vehicle to penalize instead of the white Porsche. So while I found that really annoying at the time, I guess I've actually softened on that, and it makes me work a little bit less hard. If I'm watching in car, I don't have to think, Graham. I can just look and go, oh, this is number 22.
Well, in the kind of continuing electrification of the racing fleet, and for that matter, with the sometimes rather uninspiring engine out of turbo engines as well, maybe it's time for fundamental change. Maybe one of two things you could do that I think would prove to be popular trackside, and you be the judge, dear listeners. One is that you could choose individually to play on external speakers on the car your favorite race car noise. So you could have a Matra V12 on the side of a GTD Porsche, for instance. That or your favorite song. It could be show tunes at one track. It could be heavy rock at another. And that way, when the cars are passing those marshal posts, it would be pretty easy to discern them, wouldn't it?
That is a wonderful idea. I also am curious, if someone really wants to have fun, is if you do have a car that has a livery similar to others, not necessarily within your own team, but mind you, a competitor, could you have a little bit of fun and put the incorrect car number stickers in front of the camera? But make sure that you change that. Maybe on the last pit stop, you just block the camera for a moment, throw on the correct ones, and
change the door.
Oh, I tell you, boy, that car number 14, that one's just been knocking people off track. To which point the 14 car says, what the hell are you talking about? All right, Mr. Goodwin. Well, I would say we have a full and proper week in IndyCar. Did I just say week in IndyCar? I did.
You did.
Let's just call it, we have a proper week in IndyCar episode in the books, and I'm not going to delete that or erase it. I'm just going to leave it. Man, all right, I at least need to switch from vodka to tequila in the morning, something like
or
that.
Or both.
Yeah, that's a wonderful cocktail right there. All that nonsense aside, Mr. Goodwin, thank you again. Dear listener, thank you. Didn't necessarily fail to mention it in the beginning. I was just going to hold it to the end because you'll probably will have seen the little promo graphics. But we are doing our third Marshall Pruitt Podcast live event that will be held this Saturday at Road America. Mr. Goodwin won't be there, unfortunately, so it will be me. But we're going to do that Saturday at 3 p.m. in Victory Lane. We have a certain Brazilian by the name of Elio Castro Neves, a certain GTD champion by the name of Christina Nielsen, and everyone's favorite crew chief, Dan Binks from Corvette Racing, who are going to come and spend about a half hour taking one question from me to start, and then the rest is all yours, all Q&A from you. So I'm hoping if you're going to be at Road America, you will pop by. We'll have some fun little gifts. Graham, our new Week in Sports Cars t-shirts. Those things look absolutely delightful from our friends at Toronto Motorsports. And we also have a special guest who's going to pop in about halfway through. And with all the announcements coming this weekend, he might be a guest who would be able to answer plenty of questions regarding any of the changes and or modifications that will be announced. So with all that said, I'm Marshall Pruitt. That is Graham Goodwin. You're listening to The Week in Sports Cars on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires.